Center. Get your team registered, 658-8166.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Career opportunities abound in marketing, including public relations, advertising, promotion, and international marketing. Improve your degree through an articulation agreement with one of 35 colleges and universities. Check out marketing at gtc.edu.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
And thank you, David Cole, and welcome to Walworth County and the Yerkes Observatory of the University of Chicago. I'm Jim McClure, and we're here in Williams Bay with their new director of tours and special events, Dan Kaler. Dan is a familiar voice to listeners of WGTD on our Yerkes Star Quest with Jim McClure, which I host on Thursdays and Fridays at about 12:15 on the Midday News. Dan has been a frequent contributor to the 52 shows now we've done over the past year. And Dan, we welcome you to Community Matters. And starting off with here in 2015, how have conditions for viewing changed from when Yerkes was founded in 1897?
It's still a great place to do almost any type of observing of the nighttime sky, whether it's an eclipse or it's looking at deep sky objects like galaxies and nebulas and star clusters and so on. We are fortunate in that we have fairly dark sky conditions here still in the Lake Geneva area. It's thanks to the communities here that have initiated dark sky ordinances or lighting ordinances that reduce the amount of glare that's scattered up into ambient light that's scattered up into the sky. So we're still, considering that Yerkes is sitting in the middle of some major metropolitan areas, no farther than, say, 50 miles from Madison, Rockford, Illinois, the Chicago area and all of its suburbs are not much more than about 60 or 70 miles away. Madison, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, and so on. We're sitting right in the middle of all of that. We still have very nice skies, very dark skies. A lot of my visitors who come from metropolitan areas are amazed at what they can see here versus what they can't see at the locations where they live now.
Institutions of higher learning, and especially ones of the caliber of the University of Chicago, the business of the education business goes almost hand in hand with fundraising. You don't hear that term a lot in association with Yerkes, but the fact of the matter is, not only is there fundraising here, but there are several new efforts. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Starting with, I had no idea you had a guest place to stay. What is it? Is this the Williams Bay version of staying in the Lincoln bedroom for the right donation? What's going on here?
Well, you're referring to the Morgan House, and it's named for William Wilson Morgan, or Bill Morgan, who was an astronomer here for nearly seven decades. He earned his PhD degree here at the University of Chicago. He did his master's and PhD work here at the university. And then he stayed on to teach with the University of Chicago for something on the order of 65 years. He was the last professional occupant of the particular property that you're referring to, which is the Morgan, the one that we call the Morgan House. It's recently been semi-renovated, at least spruced up, so that members of faculty of the University of Chicago's Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and I will call it distinguished guests, individuals from the affiliated with the university, can stay the weekends. It provides a place for them Something on the order of a little bit like a bed and breakfast here at the observatory. Not open to the public, but it is a brand new opportunity for people from campus to come back here to the observatory and utilize the facility and begin working again with us here directly.
Any chance you'd set up something like a Disney Epcot Center character breakfast where instead of Mickey or Minnie, Carl Sagan or Albert Einstein or Edwin Hubble show up?
Well, we actually could do something like that. It isn't a bad idea, and it would be fun to do that. But interestingly enough, you brought that up. We actually have a star party coming up in later October that is Harry Potter themed. So there's going to be more on that in the not too distant future. So we'll have an opportunity to talk to you about that as plans develop for it.
Even for those residents of the Geneva Lake area who are not into the star aspect of things or the architecture or have scientific connections, the observatory is iconic to the point that everybody looks at the area and thinks of the observatory and looks at the observatory and thinks of Williams Bay in the area. You can't get away from it. The police cars, the signs have the observatory on it. The Williams Bay Historical Society has the observatory on it. Old Keanu Reeves movies feature the observatory. And the interesting thing where I'm trying to go with this is you've got three domes. And I would bet that even the most disinterested, I want to watch the Packers instead today person is going to, yeah, and that's the place. And if you'd ask them three domes, they'd say, yeah, it's the place with three domes. And we know that you have the world's largest of its kind, the 40-inch refractor. And thanks to your work with us on the night tours, we're starting to learn in the public, I would hope, about the 25-inch from the 1960s and the ability to look at the skies. Is this third dome Area 51, or what's going on in there
with the 41-inch?
With the 41-inch.
The
okay.
Public never gets in there.
Well, the 41-inch is actually a 40-inch reflecting telescope or mirror-type telescope, uh-huh. But we call it the 41 because we have a 40-inch refractor here as well. So when you say 40 at the observatory, you're talking about the world's largest refracting or lens-type telescope. When you say 41, you're talking about our 40-inch reflector. That is on a program called Skynet. And Skynet is a very interesting, very special program for high school students. They can be from all over the world. They can be admitted. They have to apply, and they can be admitted to the program, and they can get access to that instrument over the Internet. So in the evening, the dome will open, provided the sky is clear. The dome will open, the telescope will start to turn, it'll cool down and get ready for doing digital imaging. But there's no one in that dome actually functioning with it. They are back in their bedroom, or they're in their home study, or they're someplace around the world. They're not necessarily in the United States either. They are young people who are learning astronomy, and they're using that telescope digitally, doing digital imaging over the Internet. So there's a server on the floor just below the telescope, mm-hmm. and that connects it to the Internet, and it allows one person at a time access to the telescope, and they can do digital imaging that way. So we hope and we believe that we are training the next generation of astrophysicists.
The fundraising that you're starting to do now is associated, one of the programs has to do with the 41, correct?
Actually, no.
Okay, please. I've been corrected for far worse, but
all right,
better.
No. The fundraising effort that we're going through this fall, and we have a fundraiser scheduled for October 30th, we'll be hosting that here at the observatory, has multi-functions. So for $50 per person, and we hope that people will be generous with donations above and beyond the $50. There are several different projects that we can work on with that fundraising. And there are the ones that come to mind quickly are, first of all, what we call the Fab Lab or the Fabrication Lab in the lower level of the observatory, which has lots of very cool, interesting equipment that young people can use, that even adults can come in and use, design different types of engineering projects. We've got a number of 3D printers that are quite interesting and very elaborate that they can get, that they can gain access to. So that's we still need some new equipment for and funding for the Fab Lab. So that's one of the things that will be funded through the fundraiser, or that people can donate directly to, and their money can go to that particular effort. The Morgan House is another one, the renovation of the Morgan House, and making that a better home for our faculty members that come to visit the observatory and stay overnight, or perhaps stay for several nights. Other visitors that we have from campus as well. So it's a home away from home for them here at the observatory, and it brings that home back to life again. That was a very active, it's the former assistant director's home, but it brings that house back to life again and into useful, into use for the observatory and for our staff. Then one of the other fundraising efforts that we'll have same night on October 30th is for what we call Yerkes Education Outreach, or YEO, and that is the educational component of the Yerkes Observatory mission, which is to educate teachers about astronomy and helping them to better teach astronomy in the classroom, both junior high and high school students. And then also for the summer camps that we have here at the observatory, we're going to have 6 summer camps next summer. They're basically all day camps for different grade levels, different interest levels in engineering and in astronomy. So the fundraising will go on for that. The one that's near and dear to my heart is the renovation of the 40-inch refractor. We're going to be opening that up for public viewing in the not-too-distant future. That's a first here at the observatory. That'll be a program similar to our 24-inch telescope program, only, I'll just say, on steroids, because it's just a much larger instrument. And we'll do a different type of program with that. We'll probably start outdoors doing unaided eye viewing and perhaps binocular and maybe even small telescope viewing of some objects, and then people will be taken into the big dome to use the world's largest refractor. So it's going to be a great introduction to unaided eye observing, small telescope or binocular observing, and then going to the world's largest refractor. So it's going to be a very, very interesting program. We are raising funds there to convert the telescope back over to visual use, and there is a certain amount of machining that goes behind that, and some brand new equipment, new eyepieces, a new focuser, and so on. We're going to be adding, more than likely, we'll be adding digital setting circles on it to basically point it more accurately and more easily in both right ascension and declination, the two coordinates that we use for finding objects in space. So we will be putting some digital encoders on it as well. And then we're going to start a major project to actually renovate the instrument from one end to the other and return it more toward what it looked like in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So there's a lot of brass on that telescope that got painted over in the 60s and then repainted again in the 80s. We'd like to see what's underneath that paint and bring some of that back. So the telescope in the not-too-distant future, and this is going to be a several-year project, will begin to look different than most people have seen it over the course of perhaps the last 40 or 50 years.
There is a remarkable object overhead in the sky right now about 5 o'clock, and at least to this untrained layman, it's almost eerie in that you don't associate stars with sunlight. So as the dawn is rising and it's fairly progressed into the almost the start of the break of day, there's this big, beautiful, bright object. And I would hate to be a iron ore Native American or a caveman, because I'd look up at that darn thing and say, oh my gosh, what presence has come? Do we have a new UFO in the sky, or what the heck is that thing?
Well, Venus is now a morning star, and that's exactly what you've been seeing in the sky. And it is very, very brilliant. I was out at 5 a.m. this morning, actually, looking at it for the first time since it swung to the other side of the sun. We looked at Venus for a good portion of this past year in the evening sky. So we saw it after sunset. Now it achieved what we call inferior conjunction back in July. So it passed between the Earth and the Sun, because its orbit is inside its orbit is inside the Earth's orbit. So it passes between us and the Sun. So that's called inferior conjunction. Superior conjunction is when it's 180 degrees on the opposite side of the Sun from us. So after it passed the inferior conjunction, it passed into the morning sky. So it's rising ahead of the Sun rather than behind it. So it's still relatively close to us, which is causing that brilliance. It'll gradually fade a little bit as the year progresses and we get into the winter months, but it is extremely brilliant. And it's also very noticeable in that part of the sky because there's no other bright object in that part of the sky. So there's really nothing to compare it to. So it's in a void that is it's in the constellation of Cancer, which is probably one of the most nondescript constellations that traces out the ecliptic, the apparent path of the Sun, the Moon, and the planets. So there's nothing else right in that area, no bright stars. So it's the star of the show right now.
How long will we be able to see it through fall, and is it going to be in the same relative position as you look to the east-southeast?
What's going to happen is it's going to continue to climb in the sky, so it's going to be higher in the sky as the days progress, and eventually it'll reach a point that we call greatest western elongation, so it'll be as far west of the Sun or toward the west as it can possibly be, and that will happen several months from now. And then it will start to descend. It'll start moving back down towards the horizon, and it'll disappear more than likely in the latter part of the spring next year in 2016. It'll disappear, and then it will become an evening star. We'll see it. We won't see it for a while because it'll be too close to the Sun, and then eventually it'll pop out and suddenly appear above the western horizon right after sunset. So that's the cycle. It swings from side to side, from the western side of the Sun to the eastern side of the Sun. It's this continuous cycle, this nonstop cycle of east-west, east-west that's been going on for billions of years. And so you're just seeing the exact same type of phenomenon that the ancient cultures saw as well. So Venus being actually the third brightest object in the nighttime sky, or third brightest object in the sky behind the Sun and the Moon.
Is it regular enough, Dan, that if I have a halfway decent memory, about this time next year, I'll say, oh, I got to start looking for Venus right where I saw it near the end of summer. Will it be in the same relative place in the sky next year at this time?
Yes, that cycle repeats. So it achieves, depending upon where Earth's orbit is, where Earth is in its orbit, will determine how far away Venus is from the Sun. Sometimes it reaches a very high elongation. It's very far to the east or very far to the west, depending upon how close or how far away we are from it. So a lot of it has to do with the geometry of the way the planets are lining up at the time that those things occur. Sometimes we see Venus in a dark sky for several hours, as a matter of fact, especially if that's occurring in the latter part of the year, in late fall, throughout the winter, or early spring, when we experience a lot of darkness and many dark hours. Less so when we are talking about this late spring, summer, and early fall months. We won't see it in a dark sky for quite as long. But I do recall years where it was so far to the east, so it was at greatest eastern elongation, meaning it was an evening star, that it was up until 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, which is highly unusual, but it does happen.
In this sophisticated day and age where word travels fast of, unfortunately, unsophisticated things, like people claiming that national events are all faked, or there's a speck on an astronaut's visor, therefore we didn't go to the moon, and 40,000 people at North American Rockwell are all in on the conspiracy. Do we get still in this time of our century people who look up and call the sheriff and say, boy, there's something weird out there? Do you think that, I know it's speculation, but it is an awful unusual sight.
Well, we do get questions from time to time from people who call the observatory to ask about certain objects that they've seen. I think the natural human instinct is that, for one thing, people are not looking up very much. They tend to look down, even in the evening. So they're watching where they're going, and they're watching where they're driving, that kind of thing. And suddenly a bright object will appear that is actually a perfectly natural phenomenon, Venus being an example of that. They'll suddenly look up, or they'll see the conjunction of planets, Venus and Jupiter, for example. I had a really beautiful conjunction this year in 2015 on June 30th. So the two planets appeared within 0.3 degrees of each other. That's a very unusually close conjunction of two bright planets. So that catches the eye of individuals who are not accustomed to looking at the sky critically and evaluating it, and they suddenly think, well, I've never seen that there before, so that must be something very unusual, and they draw the conclusion that it's a UFO without stopping to think that it could be some kind of natural phenomenon, which most likely it is. Venus is probably the number one object that is reported as an unidentified flying object of any of the celestial objects. Because it is so bright, we can, even in these latitudes, especially in Wisconsin, we can experience many nights of cloudy skies, many days of cloudy skies. Suddenly we'll experience a fairly clear period, and Venus will have moved in its orbit and suddenly become much more prominent. So the last time they looked in the sky, they didn't see it there. But then they weren't looking up very much to begin with, and then we had a large number of cloudy nights, and then it's finally clear, and there Venus is. It's changed position, it's moved in its orbit enough so that people are starting to recognize it. So that is fairly common that we get that kind of comment. On the 24-inch tours, I'll have a lot of people who will ask about different objects. When we go out on the South Lawn and I start pointing things out, naming the stars, it demystifies a lot of that. So that when you start putting names to things, explaining celestial mechanics and how the Earth rotates and brings us different objects to look at throughout the seasons. Once people start to really understand how astronomy works and how the sky operates, a lot of those kinds of misconceptions disappear.
Dan, you came here as a 17-year-old high school chemistry student on a tour with an instructor, wasn't it?
Actually, I came as a 17-year-old physics student. Was my physics teacher who brought me here for a tour in March of 1975. And it was part of, my physics teacher introduced me to astronomy. And he did that by way of teaching physics with astronomical examples, because the two sciences are so closely related. On that same trip was my first, I was a farm boy who grew up in northeastern Wisconsin. That was my very first trip to Chicago, was on that same day, and we went to the Adler Planetarium, and that was my first trip to a planetarium. So it was a major date in my life. And I also attended college not too far from here at University of Wisconsin at Whitewater, so I was able to come here on a fairly frequent basis and visit the observatory. In the 1980s, in 1990s, I was very active with the Milwaukee Astronomical Society. We did quite a bit of volunteer work here at the observatory, helping with some of the student observing programs. I got much more acquainted with the staff at that time, and I started studying a lot about the observatory, its history, about its instruments, about the people who made this place possible. And then through being here and studying and really doing a lot of research work, I've spent a lot of time at different archives around the country studying about specific individuals who are associated with the observatory, and doing a lot of research work on my own through reading books and collecting articles and basically taking in as much printed material as I possibly could find. I gradually gained the knowledge of the history of this wonderful place, and also the wonderful personalities of the people who made it possible, Charles Yerkes being one, George Ellery Hale being another, William Rainey Harper being a third. Those three individuals are primarily responsible for the building of this observatory. So I was asked in 1994 to join the staff as a part-time tour guide.
And now a new role for you, and this portion of the tape will probably air after that new role takes place. So tell us about who you be now.
As of October 1st, I am lucky enough, very fortunate to have been named the very first Director of Public Tours and Special Programs here at the Yerkes Observatory.
And what are you going to do with this newfound, I won't say power, but I would think we both agree, honor and exciting adventure ahead?
It's a great distinction to be given the opportunity to now go from part-time employee after 22 years of doing providing tours, escorting people through the building, really building up the 24-inch observing program with our 24-inch reflecting telescope. We're going to take everything to the next level. We are going to do many more public events. We're going to do more corporate events as well. People might be interested to know that we do perform wedding ceremonies here. We cannot function as a site for a reception, but we can certainly function as a great, beautiful venue for a wedding ceremony. We'll be doing more of those. We will, the biggest project that I'm working on right now, there are several. One is the expansion of our gift shop to 2 to 3 times the size of what it is now, so we'll be adding a lot of new different types of things for people to be interested in, as far as different types of things that are unusual, hard to find, objects and items relating to astronomy in our gift shop. A whole new apparel line will come in to the gift shop. And so that is one project, redoing all of the displays that the observatory has in its hallways. We'll be upgrading all of those and really telling a story about what was accomplished here. We no longer do astronomical research work here, but there was some wonderful, very exciting, very important astronomical research work that was done here. So our new displays will talk not so much about the building of the observatory, but what was actually accomplished here during the 100-plus years that it was used as a research institution. This is the home of modern astrophysics, so we want to begin telling that story, as well as the story of the people who were behind all of that, people like Edwin Hubble, people like Carl Sagan. There's other famous astronomers who are relatively unknown to the general population, but whose story can be told through the displays that we have here at the observatory. I think the most exciting and certainly going to be the most rewarding project that I work on is the renovation of the 40-inch refractor and opening that for public observing tours in the evening. Similar to programs that we're doing with the 24-inch telescope now, only on a bigger scale and a much more enriched program than what we've done in the past. So I'm really looking forward to the 40-inch coming back into operation. The world's largest refractor deserves a great degree of respect and admiration, and it certainly can function as a great teaching tool for the general public.
A nod to, if the term is somewhat accurate, your predecessor, and I assume in a way continuing colleague, Richard Dreiser is not going to be floated onto the ice of Geneva Lake as in a Geneva, in a Viking funeral. What do you have to say about what Richard has accomplished here and what happens from here for him?
Richard Dreiser has worked here for nearly 40 years as in several different capacities. He originally started out in the graphic arts area. He was doing photography work here at the observatory, worked in the photographic labs in the basement level of the observatory, and gradually graduated to tour duties. When I first took a tour here in 1975, the tour guides were graduate students who basically got lassoed into having to give the tours and explain how the telescope operated and how the elevated floor worked and the dome turned and things like that. They, for the most part, probably could have cared less about giving those tours. Richard really gave a voice to the tours department. He became entertaining. He made it fun. He made it interesting and exciting. He really was a pioneer of our tours program. Richard is going to continue with us for the foreseeable future. We depend upon him to be an integral part of the tours department and the tours division. So I'm very, very happy that he's going to be staying on with us. He's getting much needed help because we had essentially a record summer here in 2015 for visitors. So he has been instrumental in the success of our tours program. He's going to continue to be with us for some time to come.
And since Richard doesn't have the benefit of being with us tonight, I'm going to channel him and say in a typical Dreiser-like way with self-effacing humor, not only is he getting a lot of help, but he probably for a number of years has been recognized as needing help. But I'm glad to hear that. And in that vein, the University of Chicago, to my knowledge, has been known as a center of debate, discussion. I think it's the quadrangle table, the famous octagonal table in the center down there, where often you find Nobel Prize winners and other academics talking, debating issues of the day. I would say that the Yerkes equivalent is you and Mr. Dreiser debating back and forth about architecture, whether that's a winged griffin or a flying whatever on the terracotta. So very unfair, but you're the head honcho now. This is your chance to win one of those arguments. What do you and Richard continue to good-naturedly debate, and what is your feel on whatever that thing is or that phenomenon?
The disadvantage that Richard and I both work under is that our architect for this building, Henry Ives Cobb, very prolific architect in the city of Chicago, when he passed away in 1931, he had 10 children in total. And his oldest child was a son who was also an artist and architect like his father. And he was instructed by his father, and we have absolutely no idea why this instruction was given to Henry Ives Cobb Jr., but all of his records were destroyed. So any drawings, any record of any project that he worked on, any notes that he would have left behind, there is no archive for Richard and I to go to investigate what many of the creatures that decorate this and symbols that decorate this beautiful building really represent. So, of course, that leaves open to interpretation and independent research, and obviously different researchers will come up with different conclusions by looking and studying the same things. So Richard and I have gone back and forth about certain things. One thing that I can point out that is fairly common between the two of us are our winged lions. And Richard will refer to the winged lions, and those are the big, some people call them gargoyles. Well, gargoyles are actually humanoid.
Like certain public radio hosts who don't know from Adam. I believe I was one of the first persons to pose that question on our air. Yeah.
Those creatures that, the giant creatures that you see on the building are lion-esque in appearance. And they have wings. And so my version of the story is that they are griffins. But the true definition, and Richard is not wrong about this, he's oftentimes will point this out, is that those are St. Mark's lions, or simply winged lions, and that they are not griffins, which is what I call them. Now, the reason he believes they're not griffins is because the true definition of a griffin, and he is correct in this, is that it is an eagle's head on a lion's body with eagle's wings. Griffins always represent in mythology that they're protecting something of great value, and we believe that that's the building and the telescopes here, and we certainly hope those of us that work here as well. But my definition of a griffin is a little bit different than his. As a matter of fact, in my research work, I've seen different forms of griffins, and Henry Ives Cobb, when he designed this particular building, I believe took the adaptation, made his own adaptation of a griffin by putting a lion's head on a lion's body with eagle's wings to represent a couple of things, one of which the lion is a representation or a symbol for the sun. Its mane, the mane of a lion represents the halo, the glow that we see around the face of the sun. And of course, the sun is a great dominant force, great dominant body in our solar system, just as the lion is in nature. It's the king of the beasts, as we call it. Our griffins are crossed between the king of the beasts and the king of the birds. That would be the lion and the eagle. So that's my interpretation of it. And I think that that's a reasonable interpretation. What Richard will come across to you and say is that it's simply a St. Mark's lion, and that's absolutely true. That is what it is. St. Mark is the patron saint of the city of Venice. So many of the buildings that we see in the city of Venice in Italy have St. Mark's lions decorating them. They look almost exactly like the griffins that we see or the winged lions that we see here at Yerkes. Henry Ives Cobb did travel in Europe when he was studying. He was one of the first formally trained architects in the United States, and he attended MIT, got a degree in design and in engineering, and then came to Chicago in 1880, began his illustrious career, which lasted until nearly the end of the 19th century. He has many, many buildings to his credit in the city, but he did study for a short time at the Beaux-Arts School in Paris, and he traveled in Europe, and he picked up the Romanesque bug, I'll call it, in Europe. He was very heavily influenced by a fellow named Henry Hobson Richardson, another formerly trained architect, also from the East Coast, where Mr. Cobb was born and raised. And all of them in what we call the Chicago School, all of the architects in the Chicago School of Architecture, very heavily influenced by Henry Hobson Richardson, including Frank Lloyd Wright, who designed buildings in the classic style before he broke off and went to his own way with the prairie style of architecture. So it's entirely possible that, and Richard and I agree on this one point, it's entirely possible that he passed through Italy in his quest to examine and study the classical style of architecture. He was very influenced and felt that that was probably a style that he was going to bring back to the United States. There actually is a building called the Baptistery, which is one or two doors down from the Leaning Tower in Pisa. And if you take a look at the Baptistery and you take a look at the Great Tower here at Yerkes that houses the 40-inch refracting telescope, you'll see a great degree of similarity between those two buildings. You can almost call our tower, our 40-inch, 90-foot dome, our 40-inch tower, a near-carbon copy of the Baptistery. So when Richard calls that a St. Mark's lion, he's not far off in his assessment of it. It's just that I happen to feel that there's a little bit deeper interpretation of that one. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that Cobb would have taken a St. Mark's lion and put it on an observatory just because he happened to like St. Mark's lions. This was a solar research facility. It makes a tremendous amount of sense to me that we would have a lot of symbols having to do with the sun. And it was a tribute to Henry Ives Cobb, from Henry Ives Cobb to George Ellery Hale, who was a solar researcher, and he is considered the father of modern astrophysics. So I see all of those things combining. So you have the simple explanation that it's a St. Mark's lion, and we end with that. Or we dig a little bit deeper, and we look at it as a symbol of the sun, which ties back to George Ellery Hale being the premier solar researcher of the 19th and early 20th centuries, and the Yerkes Observatory being the premier institution that was studying the sun at the time.
In the 5 minutes we have left of this edition of Community Matters, as we speak, it's the first night of fall. As an astronomer and in your position here, what's to look forward to throughout the fall?
The fall skies and leading into the winter skies present us with a great variety of objects to look at. As the season progresses, we'll get better looks at the planets Mars and Jupiter. Those will be showpieces in 2016, but we're going to start seeing those a little bit later this fall. Several of the Milky Way continues to be a great feature of the nighttime sky to see arching over the top of us. Eventually, it sets toward the west-northwest in the evening as it progresses, but the Milky Way are the arms of our Milky Way galaxy that are stretched out over the top of us, very beautiful to look at. The Andromeda Galaxy is a showpiece of some of the programs that we have here at the observatory, one of the closest large objects to us at 2.5 million light years. A great object to study. Lots of great objects like star clusters, nebulae, a few other galaxies, the constellations, and a lot of bright stars in the fall and proceeding into the early winter sky. So fall is a great time to observe simply because sky clarity tends to be greater than it is in the summertime. We have less humidity. We have longer hours of darkness, more darkness. Some people don't like that, but astronomers tend to like it because we have longer amounts of time to experience the nighttime sky. So it's just a wonderful, the beautiful, crisp, clear evenings that extend much longer than they normally do in other times of the year. Warmer, still warm, still decent temperatures for us to observe in. So it's just a wonderful time of the year all around.
And, you know, finally, Dan, let me take a combination personal and business note and thank you on behalf of WGTD-FM and HD and Gateway Technical College and our listeners in Walworth County and Racine County and Kenosha County, Northern Illinois. It has been a total honor and a thing of wonder. And a wonderful, as we say, in the Yerkes Star Quest segments that we do weekly on Thursday and Friday, it truly has been an adventure of discovery. And I want to thank you for that. And also, again, hope, and I don't doubt, that like me, you too, still, after however many decades, get goosebumps not only looking at the stars but walking in this place knowing it's your full-time job.
Well, this all started for me in 1975, the quest of my own in astronomy, and in 1994 here at the observatory, starting as a part-time tour guide, now becoming a full-time employee of the observatory. I have taken literally thousands of people through this building. And my goal is always to impart my love of astronomy and my love for this building. I want people to love it as much as I do, and I want that enthusiasm to show. I get a lot of compliments to that very effect, that people become very excited, more excited about the place after they learn about it, after they hear the stories. And where I really have a thrill is taking people to the 24-inch telescope. And eventually the same will happen with the 40-inch telescope here as well, showing them the wonders of the nighttime sky, just little slices at a time to explain what they're looking at, why those objects are important, why astronomers study those objects, and what we've learned about the universe. I have looked at many of the same objects over and over again. I've probably looked at some of these objects 1,000 or more times because I show them to other people. I never lose my wonder, and I never lose my fascination for the objects that I'm showing and for astronomy in general. I'm constantly learning. That's what's so beautiful about this science, is it's constantly changing. It's constantly evolving. There's always something to learn. And even at my ripe old age, which I'm passing into, let's see, my seventh decade pretty soon here, I never tire of it, and I'm always very, very grateful for the opportunity to have been introduced to this wonderful science and then be able to impart my knowledge and my enthusiasm to other people.
And you're doing okay with the intrusive microphone every now and then?
I have really enjoyed doing these programs for you, Jim. It's been absolutely wonderful. It makes me realize how wonderful the science is. It also makes me realize how fortunate I have been to have been introduced to the science of astronomy, and how fortunate I am to be an employee and just a part of the staff here at the University of Chicago's Yerkes Observatory.
Thank you, Dan. It's been an honor and a privilege for me. And thank you, dear listeners of both Yerkes Star Quest and Community Matters, and wishing you a good afternoon. And dare I say, keep looking up. There's a lot to be seen. I'm Jim McClure.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at wgtd.org, click Talk and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org.